Okay, this week we're going to take a look at a piece that often gets overlooked, and we always try to make sure to cover those pieces, because here in Chutz Laaretz we're reading Matot Maseh. Back at home we're reading just Parshat Maseh, so this will actually work for both, and this is finally the week that we catch up. At the very end of Parshat Maseh, there is a story, the last chapter of Bamidbar, 13 verses. The first 12 of them are devoted to a dialogue between members of Shevet Menasheh and Moshe Rabbeinu, and then the aftermath of that, which leads to the marriages of Benot Tzlofchad. And part of the reason that this sort of surprises us, and perhaps we don't pay much attention, besides the fact that usually Matot Maseh are together, and they are very long, and together, and there's a lot of very big issues, Arei Miklat, and the Masaot, and Bnei Gad, and Bnei Reuven. I'm kind of working backwards. And, of course, at the very beginning of it all, the laws of Nedarim, we almost have a feeling like, well, we already dealt with Benot Tzlofchad in Parshat Pinchas, and this little addendum often gets overlooked. It, of course, should not be overlooked. Nothing in Torah should be overlooked. But the addendum actually raises a couple of difficulties. We'll look at it on the page. It's the it's source 3 on the back. But let's first take a look at the introduction of Benot Tzlofchad, which first takes place in the second census, which is at the beginning of Parshat Pinchas. And you notice something interesting, this is just parenthetic, but you notice something interesting is that the census, both in the beginning of Bamidbar and Parshat Pinchas, follows an order that we're familiar with, but a little bit out of order. The order is Reuven, Shimon, Gad, then Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, and then Menasheh, Ephraim, Binyamin, and then the other three. Dan, Naphtali, and Asher. And what's odd about that is that Reuven, Shimon, and Gad is a machaneh, as we find later in Perek Bet. Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun is a machaneh, but the first machaneh seems to be Yehuda. And yet, when it comes to the census, we start with machaneh Reuven, we do the whole machaneh. So it seems that we're counting them by camps, but in each case, the fact that Reuven is the Bechor, and it's mentioned here, Reuven, Bechor, Yisrael, gets Reuven pride of place. The other thing which is odd is that even though Yaakov said, Yisimcha Elohim ki Ephraim Echim Nasheh, and then the text says, Vayasem et Ephraim lifnei Menasheh, which Vayasem, Rashi says, is referring to Moshe, that Shevet Ephraim is in front of Menasheh, and for almost all of the things, Ephraim comes first, especially in the terms of the camp, and it's called Machane Ephraim. Nonetheless, in the censuses, it's Bnei Yosef Menasheh Ephraim, and then we count Menasheh first. In this second census, each one of those oddities has another oddity to it, or sort of commonality to it, is that the first tribe in each one of the first three groups has an anomaly, which is added in, which really seems to be unnecessary for the census. In the case of Reuven, there is a relatively long digression about Datan and Aviram, how they died, and suddenly Korach is mentioned, Bnei Korach, Levite, etc., in mentioning two particular members of Shevet Reuven, notable, infamous as it were, members of Shevet Reuven who died. Then we get to Yehuda, we're introduced, and this is even odder, Bnei Yehuda Er Ve'onan. And we go all the way back to Breshit Lamed Chet, and Erev Onan, the two sons of Yehuda, who were childless, and who left no progeny, and go back to Datan and Aviram, they had children, but their children were all killed, so again there's no progeny. And then, in Yehuda, we're told that Yehuda has the family of Shelah and Zerah, Peretz and Zerach, Shelah being the third son from his original marriage, and Peretz and Zerach, the twins from Tamar. And then we're told about two of Peretz's children being included, so that Yehuda has five families. Kasuto, in his commentary in Parshat Vayigash, dealing with the problem of including Peretz's sons as those who came down to Mitzrayim, because there's just too many generations being born in too short of a time, his suggestion is that really they were born in Mitzrayim, and the reason they're mentioned there is because Yehuda is supposed to have five kids, and the fact that Aaron Onan died, so these two grandchildren are making up for those, and he now has five families. And indeed, we do have five families within Yehuda. Right, that works well. But again, two sons die, no children. This is replicated later on when, in counting the Levim, we mention Aharon, we mention Nadav and Avihu, who we've already heard several times died. And again, here we're told that they died, and they have no children. And then, before that, though, but we get to Menashe, and Menashe is again placed ahead of Ephraim. In the story of Menashe, we have the following pasuk, and it's source number one on the page. B'nei Yosef l'mishpachotam Menashe v'Ephraim. And again, we're surprised by Menashe being first. B'nei Menashe, I don't have explanation why Menashe is first here, except that there seems to be a notion of highlighting these famous deaths of individuals, which impact on the makeup of the family, and ultimately the makeup of the Nachala, which the census is partially about. So this takes us a line from Menashe to his Bechor Machir to his Bechor Gilad, and then Ela B'nei Gilad, and this seems to be the main strain of families. And by the way, every time they're mentioned, we're not just told that there is a banot slavchad. The same exact line is mentioned. Lo hayu lo banim ki im banot. He had no sons, rather daughters. And what some of the farshim explain is it means that he had never had sons. So it's not as if he had sons and they had children, but then the sons died. There were no sons ever, and all there is these daughters. V'shem banot slavchad, machla v'noach, cholglam milka v'tirtza. And famously, that order keeps getting switched around in the different presentations. So notice that, except for the list of names of Gilad's kids, the biggest issue here is the mention of Benot Slavchad. And that, of course, is the introduction. Now, after the entire census, and then the important announcement, La'ela Techalei Ka'aretz, that this census helps define how the land is going to be divided up, we now get to the story of Benot Slavchad, and it's source number two, and you have it in English underneath. Vatikravna Benot Slavchad, Ben Chefer Ben Gilad Ben Machir Ben Menashe, L'mishpachot Menashe Ben Yosef, so we already knew who they were. Ve'ele Shmo Penotav, Machla Noah, V'chogla Milka V'tirtza. Vatamon L'fnei Moshe V'lifnei Elazar, Kohen V'nei Azim, V'chol Haida. So they come publicly in front of Moshe and Elazar, but also in front of all the leaders, and in front of all of the Eda, which may mean the leadership. Petach Oel Moed Lemor. They're in front of the Oel Moed, so this is a very public stand. And what do they say? Avinu Meit Bamidbar. Our father died in the desert. Well, that's not unusual. There's probably a lot of people whose fathers died in the desert, because that whole generation died out. And then they add, V'hu lo haya v'toch ha'idah no'adim al Adonai v'adad Korach. He was not part of the challengers who were part of Korach's Eidah. And that's critical because, if it were, then Korach's Eidah is people that we don't want to really remember and we don't want to continue their legacy, or worry about their posterity. And that's a critical piece to the puzzle here. Ki v'cheto meit uvanim lo hayulo. Now, v'cheto meit may mean that there is a particular sin that he did and that's why he died. And look at the machlok v'tun v'kiv v'nabi yosu v'meteira in Masachet Shabbat in the 11th parak. Or, it could just be the generic sort of thing that, you know, ein mitah b'lo chet, everybody who dies at some point is sinned, and a sort of generic way of saying he died, but the point is he didn't die as part of B'nai Korach, the Korach's rebellion, the Tanavarim, etc. Uvanim lo hayulo. He didn't have any sons. He had not had any sons. Which, of course, would mean, and they're implying here, and many of the Rishonim bring this up, had he had sons, and those sons had had daughters, we wouldn't say anything. Or his sons had sons, he wouldn't say anything, but he had no sons at all. And then the claim, Lama yigarashem avinu mitoch mishpachto. Why should our father's name be erased or diminished from his family? And a few years ago we talked about this in the context of the phrase Lama yigara, which shows up three times in Sefer Bamidbar. It shows up near the beginning with the men who come forward and do not want to be cut out. Lama nigara. Do not want to be cut out of the Korban Pesach, which leads to Pesach Sheni. And it is one of the stories in Chumash in which human initiative leads to divine modification of the law. You then have it here, Lama Yigara, which is going to lead to divine modification of the law and the inheritance. And the third time will be in the parsha we'll take a look at the end of Masay, when B'nai Yosef come forward and make the same claim about Yigara Nachalateinu, and we'll see that in a few moments, and their additional modification to the legislation is introduced. So they say, give us holding a land among whom? Among our father's brothers. In other words, if you don't give us land, who's it going to go to? It's going to go to them. In other words, if it doesn't go to girls and there's no sons, it's going to go to brothers. And so we want to have a land with them. In other words, we want to have our own land side by side with them. and that way our father's name will be remembered. Okay, it's a reasonable request, and we assume that this request is generated by an interest in maintaining the legacy of their father, of Tzlofchad, so Tzlofchad's name should not be lost. By the way, as a result of this, Tzlofchad is one of the most famous fathers in history, of course. But it's something that we've talked about numerous times in Shir, about the greatest concern that man has is, of course, to die forgotten, to be lost. And that's why we create a legacy. We have children, and we build things, and we create things, and in music, and art, and books, and all sorts of things that we do to leave an imprint on the world so that we're not forgotten. And in the ancient world, in the time of Tanakh especially, the two vehicles for immortality, if you will, were land and children, and that, of course, is the whole subtext of Megillat Rut, and that's why Geulah shows up in Parshat Bahar in the context of Geulat Karka, that if a person has to give up his ancestral land, that the family members should keep it in the family and redeem it for him, and Geulah, which in the form of Yibum, so a man should who died childless should be redeemed by having children brought sort of in his name. And again, those two coalesce in the context of Megillat Rut. And so those are the two big concerns. In the past, we've seen the Psukim in Yeshayahu Nun Vav, in which the two people who are theoretically complaining to God that they've been cut out are the Ger and the Saris. The Ger, because he has no land, and the Saris, because he has no children, the eunuch. And Hashem promises them, Yad Vashem, Veiti, he'll give them a memorial greater than children, etc. But those are the concerns. And so you understand here that as we see it, Benot Tzlofchad are coming and saying, if the land that should have our father's name on it does no longer has our father's name, and it's swallowed up by their brothers, our father's name disappears. We want to have the land. And so what happens? Moshe brings the law before God, their case, as it were, before God, for judgment. Now, we have to stop and think at this point. First of all, who are Benot Tzlofchad at this point? We know that they're orphans. We know that, meaning their father's dead, they said that. We have to assume at this point that they're not married. We have to assume at this point they're not married for two reasons. Reason number one is we're going to hear about them getting married a little later on, but you could argue that they're married now and then get divorced or become widowed, but it's not likely because if they were married now, who would come forward? Likely would be their husbands would come forward. Keep that in mind because that's going to play into a big problem that we have a little later on. But the second question is, what is it that we envision happening here? Let's say that they get land, and they're going to get land. Well, they get land. So now they get land, and they get married. So what happens to the land? The land now becomes part of the inheritance of their husbands and their sons, which follow the husband. So where's father's name in this? We have to think about that. Like, what are they going to accomplish here? The question becomes much more harif when we look at the end of Parshat Maaseh, as we'll see. So what is Hashem's answer? Vayomer Adonai al Moshe l'mor, Kein benot Tzlofchad dovrot. Benot Tzlofchad are speaking correctly. Now, tzontiten l'machuzah nachala b'tochachei avihem, give them inheritance among their uncles. Vavartat nachalat avihem lahen, and pass on the inheritance that should have gone to, that went to their fathers, to pass it on to them. Okay, so that's the ruling, and we all know what happens from there. The next piece is the laws of Nachala, and the first law of Nachala is that if a man dies without sons, it goes to his daughters. If no daughters, goes to the brothers. If doesn't have brothers, goes to the father's brothers, and then it goes to whatever closest next of kin. Shiro Karovilav is that Ba'ala, Machloket, whether Yerushat HaBa'al's Doraita. Okay, so now you have here four of the questions that I asked here at this point. The question about how old they were at the time is something that's going to come up really at a bit of a later point, but we would have to presume at this point that these girls are, first of all, old enough, at least the oldest one, to come forward and address the community, so they're not little girls. On the other hand, they can't be so old because we would assume that they would have been married by now. So we're going to put them somewhere in around 13, 14 or so, although it's totally a guess. We'll see something later that may substantiate that, but we can't, certainly cannot, likvol maspirot. We can't nail that down very well. The other question that I just want to raise is that, and Benot Tzlofchad are very famous, but you have to think about it. We're talking here about tens of thousands of households, really 100,000s of households. They have a standing army of 601,000 men. So there's hundreds of thousands of households. What's the statistical likelihood that there's only one household where there are girls and no boys. Highly unlikely. So why did they come forward? In other words, what was their particular circumstance that caused them to come forward at this time? Now, you could say that there were other girls who would have come forward, but they were embarrassed, and these girls have some moxie, as they would call it. Or you could say, as we will see a little later, that they were brilliant, and they were sagacious, etc. Very possibly. But it's still a little bit strange that only they came in. And then the question of when they actually married, as we'll see in the next piece, is not so simple. All right, good. So now let's see the next piece, and let's see what happens. Vayikrevu Rashi Avot. One of the key questions we have to ask here is why this piece doesn't come in Perak Chav Zayin. In other words, after Moshe says, B'nos Lavchad should get land, the next thing should be this piece, which is, as soon as they're granted by this new law, they're granted land, the members of Menashe should come forward with their concern and their complaint, and the law should be then tightened up, as it will be here. Instead, it's put much later. So the critics say what the critics say about this being a later addendum, etc., etc. We can't totally dismiss that only because of something that's going to come up later on at the end of this passage. But very likely what we're doing is we're talking about a passage of time. Why a passage of time? Because what's happened between, at least in the sequence in the Torah, what's happened between the story of Benot Slavchad and now? So just to recap, Benot Slavchad is chapter 27. Immediately afterwards, Hashem tells Moshe, come up to Har Avarim and die. And Moshe then makes his demand about having a leader. We talked about that years ago. And then that's when he tells Moshe to take Yoshua and to do Smicha. Then we have two straight chapters of Korbanot. Then we have the laws of Nedarim. Then we have the law, war against Midian. All of that really doesn't touch us. But then, starting with the middle of Parshat Matot, you have Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven making their claim on the land on the East Bank and all those negotiations and the land being apportioned to them. So the land is starting to be given out now. Then you have Parshat Maaseh, which is just bringing us to this point, and then the laws of inheritance, meaning who's going to divide up the land? The city's given to the Levim. What are the borders of the land? The city's given to the Levim. The cities of refuge that have to be given out. Everything's being set up for inheritance. At that point, this is when this happens. Because we have to posit that Benot Slavchad were promised land, but of course that land is waiting for all of this to happen, so nothing's really happened in the meantime. Now, Vayikrevu Rashi Avot L'Mishpachat So they also come before Moshe and the Nesiim. So again, it's a big public stand. Elazar is not mentioned here, but they come before the leaders. Vayomru, this is what they say. Et Adonit Siva Adonai, Latet Taras Menachalab Agral of Israel. The first thing is, God commanded you, our master, to give the land out based on the lottery. Famous. Vadunit suva vadunai, and you were commanded by God, latet et nachlat slavchad achinu livnotav, also to give out our brother's land, slavchad, to his daughters. Okay, very nice. Now, vayu lechad v'nei shiftei v'nei Yisrael anashim. So now let's imagine they're going to go and marry somebody of one of the other tribes, and they'll be their wives. Which means, by the way, Benot Slavchad have not married yet. That's their concern. This is going to happen. V'nigra'an nachlatan minachlat avotenu. And their peace is going to now take away from our ancestral peace, meaning that suddenly Shevet Menashe is going to have a little peace in the middle of Menashe that doesn't belong to them anymore. Why? Because let's say Machla marries somebody from Zvulun, and then they have kids. Then when they die, that land goes to the kids who are all Zvulun. So Zvulun suddenly has a peace in the middle of Menashe. Menashe loses some land. And it'll be added on to the other tribe that they marry into. Again, Yigarea, it will eat away, it'll take away from our land. Let's say when Yovel comes, it's going to stay with that tribe. It's not going to come back to us because it'll belong to them. And again, Yigarea. Okay, right. Tzav Moshe b'nei Yisrael, pi Adonai memor. So Moshe commands, is al pi Hashem, Kain matei b'nei Yosef dovrim, exactly like Kain b'not Slavchad dovrot. Meaning, they're saying correctly also. Zeh ha-davar sh'tzivah Adonai b'not Slavchad memor, v'atol b'nehem t'yan l'anashim. There was an addendum that for some reason Moshe did not state back in Perak Chav Zayin, but it's being stated now, and clearly at a separate event, because otherwise there'd be no protest. The protest came because Moshe had not stated this when he said Bnei Tzelfchad get land. And what is the ruling? That Bnei Tzelfchad can marry whoever they want. Ach, the Mishpachat Matei Avim Te'an Al Anashim, but they have to marry within their tribe. Right? And that's the very famous piece about the sixth explanation of what we celebrate on Tu B'Av. The first explanation is that Tu B'Av was the time, a couple of years after entering the land, when this prohibition was lifted, and a girl who inherited land could marry anybody in any tribe. But in the meantime, if a girl inherits land, she has to marry within her tribe. So land should not shift from tribe to tribe. Everybody should stay on their ancestral land. Okay? So it's not limited to them. Any girl who inherits land, from any of the tribes, she can marry whoever she wants, but only in her tribe. So that everybody should inherit their ancestral land. Well, we get this. So it should not go from one tribe to another. And this is emphasized that it has to stay there, but Israel are going to stay connected and cleaving to their ancestral land. Very nice. Okay. And at this point, we would expect Bnei Tzelfchad are going to now marry members of Shevet Menashe. Very good. And then it raises the same question we asked before, which is, well, where's Tzelfchad in all of this? And here we have to get into what is essentially a late 20th century construct of the hyphenated name. Something that we're familiar with in many circles today, but it may be that because they got the land and then they marry somebody, so this is going to be not only Gilad's land, but Tzelfchad's land. And somehow his name will be associated with it. It could be. This is where it gets strange. Kasher tzivah donait Moshe, kerasu b'not Tzelfchad. And just exactly the way Moshe did it, this is exactly what b'not Tzelfchad did. Now, when did they do it? Not so clear. What did they do? Vatiyana machla tirtza v'chogla v'mukha v'no'ah. Notice the order shifted. Bnei Tzelfchad, livnei dodehem l'nashim. Maybe here it's listed in order of their marriage. Who did they marry? They married bnei dodehem. Now, you have to remember, what does dod mean? So normally we translate dod, besides this kindly old man who surely gives the candy, dod as an uncle. But it's not just an uncle. Dod is an uncle who is father's brother only. Not father's sister's husband, and certainly not mother's brother. A dod is father's brother. And that's because a dod has a particular relationship of goel. We talked about that in Shirim and Rut and Parshat Bahar. And it's actually related to the word dod of beloved, because he takes special care of the family. It's part of the responsible relationship that the father's family has towards children, father's brothers, etc. So who do they marry? They marry Tzelfchad's brother's sons. Well, think about that. Had they said nothing, who would get this land? Tzelfchad's brother's sons. So in other words, they marry the exact guys who were going to get this land. So now, what did they accomplish with what they were going to do? They had 60,000, however many men there are of fighting age, in Shevet Menashe. And they dafka picked the guys who are their cousins. A little strange. And then, Mishpachot B'nei Menashe Ben Yosef Eilanashim, so to clarify, they're following the rule, they're marrying within B'nei Menashe, and it stays within Menashe. And that's the end of the Sefer, Eila Mitzvot, and Chazak Chazak V'nit Chazek. But in the meantime, what is it that they accomplished here? And what is it they're trying to do? And if the whole point is to keep Tzelfchad's name alive, then Tzelfchad's name could be as alive by having it go straight to the uncle and then to the cousins, and say, this is Tzelfchad's land that we got, as it has by going through the daughters and they marry the same cousins. So what's been accomplished? Now, there's a further oddity. If you take a look at the one passage in where Bnei Tzelfchad show up in Sefer Yoshua. Sefer Yoshua, as you know, the first 12 chapters are the introduction and the wars of conquest. Chapter Yud Gimel through Chaf Aleph, Begadol, is the division of the land. Yud Gimel is the division of the East Bank. Yud Dal is sort of a prep for the division. Tet Vav is the very big Nachal of Yehuda. Tet Zayin, a short paragraph out of Ephraim. Yud Zayin is about Menashe. Yud Chet is introduction to the other tribes, and then Binyamin. And Yud Tet is all the other tribes. Chaf is a short piece about Arei Miklat. And Chaf Aleph is Arei Alvim. And that's it. And then we have three chapters to conclude the Sefer. Now, Perek Yud Zayin, towards the beginning, you have this passage again. Again, he's always introduced that way. Not, these are benot slavchad, but he had no sons, rather only daughters. Right? What happens? This is Yoshua now. Almost exactly like we had back in Perak Chavzayin and Bamidbar. They come in front of the leadership, name the two top leaders. There it was Moshe and Elazar. Here it's Elazar and Yoshua. Maybe Elazar is put first because he's been a leader longer. In any case, and the Nisi'im. God commanded Moshe to give us land among our brothers. Brothers here meaning kin. Brothers doesn't mean siblings. They don't have brothers. Chachinu, as we see throughout Tanakh, means male kin. It can even mean treaty partners. But what it means is among the rest of Hefer's family. And so you see, he gave them land among Achei Avihen, meaning among Tzofchad's brothers' land, and ultimately their sons. Okay. Now, here's the question. Are Benot Tzofchad married at this time or not? If they're married at this time, then who should be coming forward? The simple reality is their husband should be coming forward. Our wives, and just a reality, is that typically in the ancient world, unless a woman really was on her own, like the famous Ishat Koit in Shmuel Bet Perak Yudalad, and Avigail, the way that she acts in Shmuel Aleph Perak Hafei, a woman who's acting alone, typically when it comes to greeting a king or coming to a court or something like that, it's going to be somebody who is, it's going to be the man. And so why are Benot Tzofchad themselves coming here, and why is the land being given to them as opposed to being given to their husbands? So it would seem to imply that perhaps they're still single. Why would they still be single if all the way back in Moshe's time they were given land, and the whole point of them being given land was, and then limited to who they're going to marry, was to keep it in the tribe? So that's a question we have to deal with. We're going to end off by taking a look at this source and then tie it all together. There is very little midrashic material about Benot Tzofchad themselves as individuals. However, we have this one very famous statement in the middle of Perek Yesh Nochlin, which is about Nachalat Haaretz, and a very famous Mishnah, Benot Tzofchad Natlu Gimel Chalakim. In the Gemara's discussion there's a midrash, Tani Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, Afiluk Tana Shemayan, Loni Seit Pchuta Mi'arba'im Shana. The youngest of Benot Tzofchad married at 40, or no younger than 40. So they all married in very old age. Now, where does Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov get this from? He doesn't quote a pasuk. Where is he getting it from? And then we challenge him, and it gets even odder. Eini, v'am Rav Chista, we have a tradition, niseit chutam bat esrim yoledet ad shishim. If a girl marries before 20, she'll have kids all the way till 60. Bat esrim yoledet ad arbaim. If she marries at 20, she'll have kids till 40. Ad arbaim, bat arbaim shuveni yoledet. If she marries at 40, she'll never have kids. All right, so what's wrong with Rav Elazar ben Yaakov saying he had some way of knowing they married at 40 or older, and they didn't have kids? So the answer is, mitoch shetzidkaniyotei na'asalen neski yocheved. But since they were righteous girls, therefore they had a miracle happen like Yocheved, who according to the Midrash gave birth when she was 130. So they also had kids, even though they were older and past the age when, according to this tradition of Chista, they'd be able to have kids. So we have to ask two very big questions on this Midrash. How does Rabbi Elazar and Yaakov know that they were all old when they married? And how does he know that they had kids that we have to invoke a miracle? There's two easier ways to deal with this. One is, they weren't young when they got married. And the other one was, they didn't have kids. But he pushes on both sides. We've got to wonder where it's coming from. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning and ask the question. Why are they coming forward? And the question, of course, becomes exacerbated because of the problem of what did they actually accomplish with the whole negotiation with Moshe, meaning the whole request and the answer given to Moshe. What did they accomplish if in the end they actually married the guys who were going to get that land anyways, and so Tzofchad's name is as alive or not alive as it would have been in either case? So how do we explain it? So I'd like to suggest that we need to look at this a little bit differently. In the ancient world and in the classical world, certainly through the times of the Gemara, and even in some parts of the world, well into the Middle Ages. Really put most of the world through the Middle Ages. A girl getting married, first of all, was often a financial consideration. I don't mean, like today, as in how much a wedding's going to cost, or is the guy going to work and have some way to support her. It's a financial consideration of tying two families together. And each family contributed something to make that an appealing match. And so therefore, the halakha very clearly states that a father has to provide a dowry for his daughter to make his daughter attractive as a marriage partner. Now, if there's a son, so the son inherits property, the son is wealthy, he inherits property, he can take a wife. If there's a daughter, and there are sons, the sons inherit the property, and the sons are obligated to take care of their sisters and make sure that they are given an appropriate dowry to make them attractive. Benot Slavchad, and it is possible that at least one of Benot Slavchad is exactly at marriageable age at the point of the census. And the fact that they're at marriageable age, or one of them is at marriageable age, and maybe that's not happening in a lot of other families without sons, where father has died, there are no sons, there are only daughters, and there's a daughter of marriageable age who's not yet married, which is the issue. That you could have one of. So they come forward and say, here's the problem. Our father died. What's our concern? Lama yigarash shem avinu. Why should our father's name be wiped out? Why would our father's name be wiped out? She could argue because there won't be any land on his name. But let's be honest, there won't be any land on his name anyways, because it's going to end up with your husband's name. What is it that there is really a real concern? I'd like to suggest they're concerned about progeny. Father's name is going to be wiped out because father will die childless, meaning he will die, he died, we will never marry, we will never have kids, and his line will die out. Which then explains why Menashe is set up parallel to Yehuda, Aaron Onan died childless, and Reuven, Datan Avram died childless. And so Tzlofchad is gonna die out because we won't be able to marry. Why won't we be able to marry? Because we bring nothing to the marriage. We don't own land, and we don't have brothers who are going to take care of us with a dowry. And so therefore, they come forward and say what? Lama yigarashem avinu. I'm looking at source 2, pasuk dalet. Lama yigarashem avinu mitoch mishpachto ki in lo ben. What does it mean ki in lo ben? Why should father's name be wiped out just because he has no son? Meaning, since he has no son, therefore there's no one to take care of us, and therefore the land will go to our uncles, and we'll have nothing, and we won't be married. Tana lanu achuza mitoch achay avinu. Give us some land. So what does Hashem say? Kein benot slavchad dovrot. They have a correct point. Which means that this is a fix of a legislation which is not motivated by land ownership, but by marriage. And Benot Slavchad really are correct in saying there's got to be a fix for the law to make sure that girls who are orphaned and don't have brothers have something to make them attractive marriage partners. Okay, so now what happens? The rest of Shevet Menashe, the representatives of Shevet Menashe, come to Moshe. This is on the second page again, source 3. And they say what they say, and they're concerned about what they're concerned about. And what does Moshe say back? Good concern, good point. So in order to take care of the fact that they want to marry and have kids, we allow them to have land. But in order to make sure that the land doesn't get lost to the Shevet, they have to marry within the tribe. That leaves a big swath of men from whom to choose, and they're probably very attractive marriage partners now because they actually own land, unlike a dowry, and they own land in Shevet Menashe. And so therefore, this actually works to their benefit. So now, Vatiyera Machlan Tirtzach Oglam Ilka Vino'a Benot Slavchad Livnei Dodehem Lanashim. Who do they end up marrying? They end up marrying actually their cousins, the same guys who are going to get the land. But that's fine, because the concern was not land. The concern was getting married and having kids. So they end up marrying their cousins, which is the easiest thing because, by the way, land-wise, the land is now adjacent because their land is inherited right next to their cousins. And they're comfortable with their cousins, and there's no reasons not to marry them. Now, here's where we get into a little bit of a difficulty. So how come in Yehoshua they come forward? I like to suggest that they married their cousins, but they married their cousins, and Moshe was not the Masada Kedushin Yeshua was. They were married by in Yeshua's time. Okay, which will leave us a little bit of a difficulty, which we're going to go back to, of how the pasuk's in Bamidbar. But that's why they come forward in Yehoshua themselves. Why is it they didn't get married? Because we're about to fight a war. This isn't time for marriage. In other words, Bnei Yisrael are in Arvot Moab. We're about to move now. Moshe's about to die. We're about to move. We're going to go and conquer. We're going to be at war. The men are going to be at the front, etc. It's not a time for marriage. We'll wait till all that dust settles, till the war is fought, till land is divided, and then marry. And especially when the marriage has something to do with land ownership. So wait till that happens. So therefore, we wait until after the war of conquest, the division of the land, and we get to the land of Menashe, they come forward and say there was a promise given to Moshe, just like Bnei Reuven and Gad and Chatzi Sheva Menashe say in Perek Aleph, a promise given to Moshe, and he says, I'll honor the promise, and just like Kalev does, saying that he had Hebron, and I'll honor the promise, and he gives them the land. And then, I'd like to propose, at that point is when they get married. Right? Which is why Reuel Ezer Ben Yaakov says they married at 40. In other words, again, to pin down the exact numbers is difficult. But that's where Reuel Ezer says, Ben Yaakov says they married old, because they approached Yehoshua at a time that they were already of marriageable, Moshe, at a time that they were already of marriageable age, but they had to wait until all of this war was over until they could actually marry. So how does he know they had kids? So it's interesting, we've actually found Charasim, we've actually found pottery shards from towns in the north near Har Eival that have the name Chogla on them, which seem to indicate that Chogla actually had a lineage, and that might have been one of the towns, and Badan was one of the towns maybe that was of her family. But regardless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Kein Banot Slavchad Dovrot, meaning he's confirming their concern. And if I'm right that their concern was a concern for progeny and for keeping Slavchad alive through grandchildren, then of course they're going to have had children. And if they were older, then of course it happened B'nais, and that's the nace that Reb Elazar ben Yaakov is leaning on. So Reb Elazar ben Yaakov is anchoring the two claims he has, that they married old and they had children miraculously, based on his understanding of where this entire motivation of Benot Slavchad came from and how it played out, and of course the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu confirmed it would then make it almost an understood piece that they're going to have kids. Now, going back to the Pasuk, this is the last piece of the puzzle, going back to the Pasuk at the end of Bamidbar, so how do we have Machlat Yitzchak Choglam Kavanoah marrying their cousins if the marriage only took place in Yehoshua's time? So the truth is, it's not difficult. It's something we've seen many times. We saw it a few weeks ago when we looked at the issue of Chorma. We saw it, and the Ramban there talks also about the story of the Man. In the story of the Man, as a quick example, the Torah in B'Shalach tells the whole story of the Man. The Man came every day, etc., Shabbat, etc. And then, two big closers. One is that Hashem told Moshe to tell Aaron to put a vial of the Man in front of Hashem. He puts it in front of the Edut. The Edut, of course, is the Mishkan. The Mishkan is not built. The Edut is the Aron. It's in the Mishkan. None of that is built. It's an Edut to an event that hasn't happened yet. Okay, so that's written at the end of the 40 years. But the big kicker is, Bnei Yisrael achlu et haman 40 shana, ad boam el eretz lo shavet, to the man achlu ad boam el ksei eretz kanan. That they ate the man until they got into the land. Well, that happened after Moshe. So the Ramban there seems to indicate, in his comments on Chorma, that pasuk was actually added in later to reflect a completion of the story, and it was added in B'nevuah. And so therefore, you could say the exact same thing here, that this Pasuk Yod Aleph in Perek Lamed Vav is added in later when Machlat Yitzchak Choglam Milkav Noah married. Now look carefully at the Pasukim and you'll see it. In Pasuk Yod it says, Kasher Tzivah Adonai Moshe Ken Asu Benot Slavchad. Meaning, it doesn't mean that Moshe was there. Hashem commanded Moshe what to do, and that's what Benot Slavchad did. They married their cousins. Right? Then, in Yehoshua, they still come forward as, I'd like to suppose, as single girls. And after he grants them the land, then they get married, and it's put in to complete the story at the end of Bamidbar. So hopefully we've gotten a better understanding, both into the motivation of Benot Slavchad, and the context of their request, and the way that this somewhat unusual Midrash really is formulated, based on an understanding of those things. Okay?